Okay, go ahead, Wayne.
Greetings. I want to extend my appreciation to all of those selfless workers behind the scenes that make these presentations and other ones via the Moya School available. It's not just technical skills, it's the devotion, the heart energy, the persistence of doing something similar to this for years. And I am very impressed that at 80 years old, I'm still just as enthusiastic as the first presentation I made. On many of the presentations I've made in the past, they were often a little longer than the time that we had to work. And so I sort of piled many of those up in a certain folder, and I went back and I wanted to share some of the insights that actually went with another presentation, but they were valued enough to almost stand alone. So that's what we're going to be doing today. Going to have lots of room for feedback. We're going to see several videos and discuss them and add a few more insights by the Tibetan and other masters. So, again, thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule to be a part of this. Now, the opening picture actually looks like something crocheted or woven with threads, but it's actually a biological motor. And if anyone had sort of shared that with me, I'd say a biological motor. As we'll see from the coming video in a few slides, that this was the tail end of a presentation on wheels within wheels within wheels that mainly was derived from cosmic fire. You have monadic wheels, you have solar wheels, you have personality wheels, you have all these spherical entities, because when he says wheels, he means spheres. And a sphere, we know, is a vortex. It has an entry point at the top and an exit point at the bottom. But it's hard to fully grasp how some of these very abstruse and cosmic principles and laws can actually apply on these very, very minute levels, like in biology and physics and chemistry, three areas that I was not really paying attention to when I was in high school, even if I did just squeak by with a C minus. So this is going to be somewhat of a departure, but I think it's going to be very creative and it's going to really help ground out on some of the lowest levels these ageless wisdom principles and laws. Okay, I want to open this presentation with a wonderful quote by the Tibetan, where he says, "Knowledge can be expressed in concepts and precepts. Wisdom is revealed through ideas against which very frequently much mundane knowledge powerfully militates. The concrete mind often inhibits, as you well know, the free flow of ideas intuitively impulsed. It is with this free flow of the new ideas that the initiate is basically concerned, because it is ideas their right application and interpretation, which determine the future of humanity and of the planetary life. When I first read that quite a few years ago from one of the Tibetans' Dina books, I just thought, isn't this a contradiction? What exactly is he saying here? And it took me a little while to figure out, as I studied the Ageless Wisdom, that the mental plane is made of seven subplanes. The three higher are actually linked to the soul. The fourth subplane is a transitional spot between the three lower and the three higher. And the three lower are not linked with the soul. They are involutionary in nature, and they are linked to the lower levels of the astral plane. In fact, HPB wrote a commentary on what she called Kama Manas, where she described them as these two lower principles, the lower mind and the lower astral body, working symbiotically in conjunction to build these barriers that prevent the student and the aspiring disciple to reach higher levels. So there's no contradiction here in this comment that DK is making. When you simply have information, when you simply have thoughts that revolve around the lower subplanes, they can prevent intuitive thought. And this is something Michael Robbins eloquently expressed in his wonderful presentations, that the mind has multiple levels. And beyond the human condition with these seven subplanes, you have the mind of God, and that has seven subplanes. So when people demean the mind, they really should state that it's the undisciplined lower mind, the uncoordinated, the undirected lower mind that causes problem. Because the lower mind can be a great place to begin and a great receiving agent for grounding. Anyway, we've discussed this in many occasions, and this is a little repetitive, and I apologize for that. But the mind is very versatile, and the new Aquarian mind that's taking hold now historically is distinctly different than the old Piscean mind. But when that Aquarian mind takes over, the Piscean mind just automatically, when the light is strong enough from the soul, it just conforms. It just moves into its rightful place, as the Tibetan says. Okay, before we begin the main presentation here, I want to share a little video that Dana House shared with me just a few hours ago. And it demonstrates not only some aspect of the Ageless Wisdom teachings, but it clearly demonstrates the potency and power of AI, that when in the hands of an illuminated mind and an open heart, it can have incredible potency. These images that are going to flood into your higher astral plane and your higher mind are exquisite. So thank you, Dana, if you're with us. I know you have many other things to do, but for your constant sharing. I do get them and I do watch them, and this is a perfect example. So take a deep breath, relax, and use this meditation. Use this short video as a meditation.
So now I embark upon most treacherous seas to describe the great dawn. It was the consciousness of the All that dreamed it. The Kybalion reads, for if the All be All, how could it create? If within lie nail and wood, then how can thee build beyond thyself? The solution is to build from within. 'Twas the imagination that dreamed it.
Oh, how this hints of a philosopher's riddle. Nay, for behold creation itself. Imagination was the genius that gave rise to this divine stage, the genesis of this celestial canvas. For the reason why is but a philosopher's theory. Perhaps for the all to experience the many.
Perhaps like the drop experiences for the sea, the all explores itself through the free will within me. Oh, the all in conscious motion spark the logos.
The thought within the dream. The logos is likened to a god.
Note the lowercase, for the logos is but an apprentice.
As a child is to the father, the apprentice to the artist. The logos to the all.
The grand artist bestowed the tools of brush and paint unto each child. Of this was given to all without exception. The brush is of love, not built with love, but is of love itself.
'Tis the grandest tool the artist blessed unto the apprentice. The light, 'twas the paint by which to create. Free will, 'tis the color within the light. For each young artist may paint their own unique essence upon the canvas.
So many apprentices took their place upon the celestial stage within the dream of the All, seated proudly with their instrument, their canvas and tools for a universe to create.
Oh, the task to construct the stars.
Delegate.
Delegate each aspect to another.
And so bore the sun.
And the sun bore the earth.
From logos to logos. Ooh. To infinite sublogos.
Thee and I were birthed co-creators to the all. Children of the universe upon this great canvas. Dost thou now see the intention of it all?
We are all drops in the ocean.
With the mutual purpose to create experience.
With, and for the dreamer.
By thine own expression upon the canvas. The genius of our own creation. Now, what to paint?
AI is only as good as those who are manipulating or using it. I recall the Tibetan stating that the greatest art of all is Aquarian thinking. And when Aquarian thought matures and bursts forth, it affects every domain on the planetary levels. And this is some of the new art that Tibetan has spoken of. You can create through AI whatever you can imagine and visualize by feeding it in and seeing the results. And I encourage others not to be intimidated by AI simply because, like most new innovative things, they're misused for devious or selfish purposes. Okay, excellent.
Hey, it's me, Destin. Welcome back to Smart.
Now, before we jump into this next video, I want to point out that we're sort of shifting from more of the fourth ray, the 246, right on to a very solid fifth ray video, which is quite long. It's maybe 25 minutes. And it's a fascinating study of an engineer who stumbles across some research in microbiology that he's fascinated by, and he seeks out more information. So it's like a little journey. And this man begins to question, as the end of this video transpires, what is behind this magic? What is behind this marvelousness of the human body in cells and bacteria and germs and the blood and all the organs? So put your thinking caps on. This is quite technical, but you're going to love it.
Hey, it's me, Destin. Welcome back to Smarter Every Day. This is the 300th episode, which is cool. Thank you so much for watching. I was on the internet the other day. I was just scrolling on my phone. I was probably wasting too much time. But I came across this amazing animation that blew my mind. It's a motor that appears to be made out of molecules. And I'm a mechanical engineer. When I saw this thing, I was like, that's a motor. Like, that's a spinny thing that has a power source. It has an axle of some sort, and it is moving. Furthermore, this one, I have a little switch here, can reverse directions, which is amazing. So I thought, I've got to get to the bottom of this, because the implications for a biomechanical motor are insane. Now, specifically, the thing this is called a flagellar motor. You may have heard of the flagellum on the back of sperm or on bacteria. That's what this is. A flagellum is that whippy thing in the single cellular organism that helps provide locomotion, but I've never thought about that thing has to spin, which means it has to have like a shaft it rotates around. It's just the implications are wild. So the more I got to reading about this flagellar motor is what it's called, the more I realized this is a really big topic, not only in biomechanics and things like that, but in philosophy. Like the complexity of a flagellar motor implies many things about the origin of life. And I'm not going to answer that in this video, but it raises questions that people are debating and they're talking about, how can this be? It's so complex. And well, you don't understand the time involved with how this came. All this is fascinating. So I just wanted to see it. So to get to the bottom of how this thing is, I decided to go to the researchers that made the image, which is a guy at Vanderbilt University. So today on Smarter Every Day, I did this about a month ago, just got in the car, drove to Vanderbilt, and we're gonna learn about a flagellar motor. Let's go get smarter every day. So I bobbed and weaved my way across the Vanderbilt University campus till I got to the School of Pharmacology and connected with Prashant Singh.
Yeah, doing well. Nice to meet you. How are you?
Yeah. Prashant is a senior research associate at the Iverson Laboratory at Vanderbilt. Just to give us whole context here, you have written a paper with your team in Nature, what was the?
Microbiology.
Nature Microbiology.
Yes.
And it's about a motor.
Yes.
That's made of molecules.
Yes.
That's on bacteria.
Yes.
Okay, well, can you show me where on a bacteria the
yes.
motor is?
Sure. So if you see on the screen here, this is how a bacteria looks like. And the bacteria has two membranes. These two membranes protects the bacteria from getting disrupted.
Or so we're talking about the outer shell of
outer
the bacteria.
Outer shell of the bacteria.
Okay.
So if you see here, there will be two membranes, the orange and the blue. Now, zoom into that.
Okay, so it's almost like a submarine. Forgive me, Prashant. I'm going to say a bunch of engineering terms because I'm an engineer.
I understand.
So it feels like a submarine with the outer hull and then the inner pressure hull.
That's correct. My dad was a submarine. So
was he really?
Yeah, he was an Indian Navy submarine so for 20 years, 15 years. Yeah.
So this bacteria in my head is kind of like a submarine.
Yes.
Okay, and is this the propeller of the submarine?
That is correct. This is the propeller or the flagella. Now, this submarine does not have a rudder. It doesn't have a rudder, but it uses a propeller to turn as well as swim. So what we see here, the two membranes that are here, and there's proton filled in here.
Did you say protons?
Yeah, it's filled with protons, hydrogen ions in here.
And
it's
hydrogen ions, okay.
Yeah. So there are hydrogen ions in here filled, and on the inside here, there's very little hydrogen ion. So okay. There's a gradient.
Forgive me, so yeah. We have to go slow for me. When you say proton, you're meaning an atom that is lacking an electron.
Yes, just a proton, it's a hydrogen ion.
Okay.
So this is high concentration of protons in this region,
okay,
and low concentration of proton in the inside of the bacteria.
Okay.
So now protons, every time there's a gradient, for example, there's a dam, water is up there and there's less water, there's a gradient, energy can be generated or it could be used, that potential energy could be used to kinetic energy and generate.
So there's a potential difference of electrochemical force of some sort.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the gradient that this motor uses to turn itself. So what happens is, if you see here, this flagella, which is a propeller, is connected to a motor system.
How does it know when to turn the motor on?
There are sensors on the outside of the bacteria. So once it knows that there's a threat or there's more energy near me, it senses that it gets a chemical signal. And there's a cascade of signals that go through, and one of the protein well known for this is called Key, C-H-E and Y, capital Y, Key. So the moment it senses that I need to run away from this location or I want to go to a different location, that protein comes and binds to it. And it encourages the motor to turn in clockwise direction.
Okay, so we need to talk about what you just said.
Yeah.
Because you just created a coordinate system inside the bacteria.
In the bacteria, yeah.
You put sensors on the outside of the bacteria.
Well, it already exists. Yes.
Okay, there are sensors on the outside of the bacteria.
Yeah.
Somehow the bacteria knows where a sensor is triggered and it knows how to trigger what motor on what side of the bacteria.
Yes, and to how to turn it.
And which direction to turn it?
Which direction. So that particular protein will make it go in clockwise. So this is clockwise direction.
Okay.
When it is not attached to it, it will go in counterclockwise. So the default motion is counterclockwise. When the motor turns counterclockwise.
You say counterclockwise from which direction?
From this direction.
From the outside. Okay.
Yeah. So counterclockwise would be this.
Okay.
And when the motor is running in counterclockwise, the bacteria will swim forward. So like it's just the boat goes straight.
And that has to do with the shape of if I were to design this.
Yeah.
I would say that would have to do with the shape of the impeller. So the tail?
Yes. The way the flagella is made, it's like a whip. So when it starts rotating, it thrusts, the force goes backwards and it moves it forward.
Okay.
Now, you would think that it would also do the same thing when it's going in the opposite direction, right?
Yeah.
Now, what happens is when it's going in the counterclockwise, there are multiple flagellas on the bacteria body. All of them start forming a bundle.
Yeah.
And multiple propellers form into like one big propeller and pushes this straight and it goes boom, straight. Now, when it has to like, it senses like there's a danger, I need to stop, I need to reanalyze my situation at gradient, I need to test, I need my sensors on and test it again. It turns clockwise. When it does that, the bundle opens up. And when they open up, it just pauses the whole bacteria and the bacteria starts tumbling all around.
Starts floating, 60 degree, yeah.
And
it no longer has a certain, there's got to be a word Latin in here, taxis.
Yeah, chemotaxis.
Chemotaxis.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So we call this whole process of bacteria's mobility like chemotaxis. It's a chemical signal that allows the bacteria to taxis or move from one place to another.
Okay.
Everything happens in like milliseconds. And there are some videos that show like bacteria moving from one place to another. And it's just like crashing. It's a biased random walk. And researchers have done this experiment. There's a petri dish, and they put food in the center and put bacteria on the edges of it. And you would think the bacteria would go straight to the food, but no, it just goes a little bit straight, then turns around and goes in the wrong direction, realizes, oh, I'm in the wrong direction, goes back. So that as a person, you think random.
I'm getting emotional now because there's a missile that I've worked on in the past, and it has what we call pulse width modulation control. And so what we do is we take the fins on the side of the missile and we dither them. We go like that. And then all we do is we bias the dithering up or down. We go.
Whoa.
So it's constantly moving, but we just bias it just a little bit in order to make a movement. And so what took us a long time to figure out, you're just describing it. This molecule or this bacteria has an operating system.
Yeah.
It has sensors.
Yeah.
It has effectors. It has actuators.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it has feedback.
Yeah,
and has feedback. I'm getting emotional.
I know.
Because it's a neat design, is what I'll say.
It is. And over the years, this design has evolved to be so perfect. It just takes some time, but it does go where it's supposed to go.
Okay.
It doesn't have eyes like we do. It figures out by sensing and moving in directions.
It's an emergent behavior based on a few inputs.
Yes.
Emergent behavior?
That's a good term.
So the structure of this motor, is it well known in the community? Like in all of research, people know about this?
They have seen a low resolution structure. So basically, if I blurred this up, they have known that for 15, 20 years. They have known it looks like this blob. There's a ring at the bottom, there's a ring on the top, but what we have is a high resolution structure, meaning we can see each and every amino acid.
So I noticed on your video, there is, it's almost like a big gear and a small gear.
Yes, that small gear is MOT-AB. That is what the proton comes through, and that's what turns this thing.
Prosh explained that the MOT-AB, the little part that spins like an ion pump, is able to interact with this band of red called Fly-G, and that has the ability to pivot 180 degrees, which enables the motor to change directions. So in your animation, you have one small gear going in. Is it literally one small gear, or are there many all around?
There can be. It can employ more if it needs more torque. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, up to 11 is what we see can fit on there, but maybe 12 or 13 as well. But we don't know exact number how many can be employed. But it is a sequential increase depending on the load.
Okay.
Of the flagella.
Okay, so I'm going to get all engineering with you now. So if you have a torque, you have to have a thing to react against.
Yes.
So that little pinion, I'll call it, the little, what did you call it?
MOT-AB.
MOT-AB?
MOT-AB.
MOT-AB.
Yeah.
So MOT-AB is this little thing that's driving it.
Yes.
Is it pinned to the sidewall or something? What is it?
Yes, it's also in this inner membrane. So it's right here. So there's multiple colors that you see, orange, cream, and green. This all is one MOT-AB.
Okay.
And it takes protons or hydrogen ions from the top and goes into the low gradient here. And as it's doing it, it makes interaction with this red protein here. And this rotates, and it causes the motor to rotate.
Okay, but it's kind of pinned in that wall.
Yes, it is pinned in this membrane, but it can go round. And it can shift a little bit in and out. MOT-AB is only turning in one direction. It cannot go in two directions. Here, the energy is only going from top to bottom. So how does this motor go in two directions? And that does because the MOT-AB, first it's outside, but when it has to go in the other direction, the red protein turns 180 degrees, pulls the MOT-AB with it, and then MOT-AB keeps doing what it's doing. It's churning in the same way, but that causes the motor to go in the other direction.
It's like shifting into reverse in a manual transmission car.
It's almost like bacteria has a reverse gear. Reminds me of my motor that my grandfather worked on, where there's copper coils that he's making, putting in these old, rebuilding these motors and putting fresh copper coils. And it reminds me of that kind of structure.
Because your grandfather was an electrical engineer, right?
Electrical engineer. He used to build and rebuild motors at factories.
Is it fun to know that you're working on motors now, just like your grandfather?
Yes, it is. It feels very rewarding to be working on something that my grandfather worked in the past. Obviously not the same scale, not the same thing, but just to know that I'm working on motors is fun. It's it's rewarding.
Okay, this is incredible. I love this. And we're going to come back and talk to Prash later to understand how he got these images of the motor. But to get more context, let's go over and talk to Dr. Tina Iverson, who runs this lab. She's the PI, or the principal investigator. This is Dr. Iverson, and this is your lab, right?
This is my lab.
So congratulations on getting this published. That's a big deal. And simply put, what have you found here?
So we are looking at really this nuts and bolts of how bacteria can move, how they can move toward something that attracts them, like a food source, and how they can move away from something that would kill them, like an antibiotic. Bacteria are moving toward a food source as driven by their metabolism.
Okay.
And metabolism is like the foods that you eat. It's how you bring in energy into your body. But we're asking that question at a larger level, not just for bacteria, but for human cells. How does metabolism affect what our cells do in a way that dictates their cell fate? And so we were trying to understand, just at a general level, why does metabolism change what cells do?
I feel like every time we as humans have the ability to see smaller or farther, we make big discoveries.
Yeah.
Do you feel that?
Oh, yeah. And I think that one of the ways the entire field is going now is, there's been this ability to image very small things with fine detail, but sort of medium and larger things in the cell with more blob-like characteristics.
Oh, okay.
And some of the new technologies are now getting to these larger assemblies of proteins at finer details.
So we're seeing the overall system.
Yes. So before we were putting the system together from component parts, and now we're seeing the system more and more intact. And these bridges between the molecules at an individual level, which can tell us a lot about how they work, but molecules together working in concert tells us much, much more.
So we've got this motor that for the first time we can see an image down to the protein level. The question is, how do we get that image? How is Prash able to see this motor and understand its component parts in a way we haven't been able to understand previously? To answer this question, Prash took me over to the imaging lab where they use a series of cryo-electron microscopes to look at the structures to understand how they work. He introduced me to Miriam and Scott, who were kind enough to show me around.
So now we're with Scott and Miriam, and these are the imaging experts. Am I saying that correctly?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, does that work?
Absolutely. So all of our sample goes onto a grid that's right here. It's a mesh work on there.
Yeah. What's it made out of?
Copper. So they can make it made out of copper, gold. There's some other materials that we use for other very niche purposes.
Yeah. Okay.
But most of them are copper.
You have whatever sample you have that's in a buffer. It will get plunge frozen. You literally just drop it in, drop your sample into liquid ethane, and just gets flash frozen. So your sample is in vitreous ice.
We're just making a network that can hold little tiny sheets of ice with protein trapped in it.
So that's what you start off with. And then after plunging, then we like load it into that little cartridge.
Our middle room here is our Glacius microscope, so we'll walk in and look at it. So this is the Glacius. This is our screening microscope.
So this is like a quick look.
This quick look. We have a source at the top that transmits an electron beam all the way through the column, and we put our sample in the middle and a detector at the bottom.
So you're shooting through it.
We're shooting transmission. We are going all the way through that sample.
The process that the scientists use to get these images is incredible, and I'm going to take a crack at explaining it with a super sophisticated animation style. So behold markers and paper. All right, so there's two types of bacteria at work here. You've got Salmonella and E. coli. Now, Salmonella, that's where the flagellum motor is located. That's these little yellow things back here. So that's the flagellum, and that's the little motor. E. coli, a different bacteria, has a little factory in it that can make things if you tell it what to do. So this process is called transformation. So basically, I just took that motor off, and I'm not going to put the motor itself into the factory in E. coli. I'm going to put the instructions of how to make the motor into E. coli. E. coli is not the only type of cell that has a little factory like this, but this is the one that the scientists chose to 3D print this particular motor. This is called transformation. This little factory goes to work, right? It makes a bunch of these little motors, and then you have a bacterial cell that has all these little protein structures in it. The act of creating this is called expression. We are now going to take all of these motors and do this process called purification. We're going to pop this, and we're going to use this grid, and we're going to basically dump all of the stuff that's been purified onto this grid array. We're going to flash freeze it, and then after that, we're going to use this really fancy 200 kVA microscope, and we're going to go through, and we're going to look at the grid. Now, when we look at the grid, we're going to screen these, so this is kind of like a course view of what we're doing. We're going to go through, and we're going to say, hey, look, there's one right there. That's important. Over here, oh, that's important. And then you're going to go all the way through this whole grid, looking and see which one has motors in it. How many motors does it have? It might be a lot. You're then going to move it over to the big microscope, the 300 kVA microscope. And that's where we're really going to take our close-up images. So what they do is they zoom in, and then they're going to take 50 frames of each individual little motor. The reason they have to do that is because at this level, you're down at the angstrom type level, like the atomic level, things shake a little bit down at that level. So you have to take 50 images in order to compile that together. You have to make sure you take out that dithering. So at that point, you then have an image of a structure. Now that structure at that point, it could be like this, it could be like this, it could be at any number of different aspects, and Prash is going to tell us what he does with that information. Before we talk to Prash, if you want to learn more about microscopy and how the scientists do all this, I've got way more information over on a video on the second channel, which is Smarter Every Day 2. Go check that out if you want to learn more about this.
So you get the images from the microscope.
So when you get the images from the microscope, they look somewhat like this.
And I can see the little crown looking thing there. Is that the bottom of a motor?
Yeah, this is the bottom. This is a top view. So I would say that this is how it looks. This motor right here is the view of this one.
Okay.
And then there is this view right here is a side view, something like this.
Okay.
So we click on all of these particles, meaning we pick those proteins by hand and using the computer. We run a program of 2D classification, meaning we run a program where all these particles that has been picked so far are similar looking particles are put together into classes. And what we see here is some are just junks, and some are actually our protein complexes.
So you go through there and you pick the ones that are the good stuff.
Yes, exactly. So this looks like a good stuff. This is a good complex. This is good. This is good. But these are not. So we don't select those, but select the good particles and put them together into a program for 3D modeling now. So we have 2D classes.
Yeah.
Once we have 2D classes, we put them together here to get a 3D version.
So you build a 3D model, like you make these shapes actually match up.
Yes, each of those classes on pictures that we saw, we start matching them up as to which one is the top view, which is the side view, and program starts doing matching those up, and it does a very good job at doing that.
So it's really the ability to replicate so many that's the secret sauce. You have the transformation, putting that information into E. coli to replicate, and then E. coli expresses it. That's expression and then purification. So transformation, expression, purification, that's how you get it done.
Once we get the 3D model, it looks something like this. We can see all sides, and now what we see is a low resolution model. We try to collect all the good signals and remove all the bad signals and try to come up with a high resolution structure. So what you see here is an 8 angstrom, and from here 8 angstrom to 4 angstrom, it took us about 2 weeks to get there, 2 to 3 weeks.
You're removing bad data to get to the high resolution.
Get to the high resolution.
And then once you get to the high resolution, then you actually start drawing and mapping the proteins.
Yes, exactly. To get this map, we're trying to put the pieces in, the puzzle pieces in, and try to find what protein, what amino acid goes in which place. So since we know the sequence of the protein, we have the pieces. We just have to fit it in this electron density.
So we have these 2D images that we wrapped together using software into a 3D model. And at this point, we know it's made up of proteins, which are made up of amino acids. And so the question I had is, how do you know what chemical is where? And it's my understanding that biochemists are just smart, and they know that certain amino acids are shaped in certain ways, like physical shapes. So it's like a puzzle piece, and they just know what they look like. So they're like, oh, here's blobophyll, or here's quadrilline. I don't know these words, but they can like physically put the puzzle pieces in on the computer, and they can figure out what the structure looks like, which is incredible.
So if you see this curve, there's a curve here.
The coil, yeah.
The coil, and that's alpha helix. This coil, now we know alpha helix, only certain amino acids make in a certain orientation or sequence would make that coil.
Yeah.
So these prior information helps us trace this puzzle. So if you see now, we can fill these gaps with these proteins.
And this is a shape, a biochemist person would not be intimidated by this shape.
No, no, that's very common. It's commonly found in almost every protein. Not every protein, but like 90%.
It's intimidating to me. It looks like a bunch of squiggles. And, yeah, but this is normal.
This is normal.
And so this is easily interpretable data.
Yes, it is.
Did you map these by hand and then just turn the image on? Is that what just happened? Or did you tell the computer to find the shape?
No, we mapped this. Our previous researchers have mapped this in the past. We used the information as like, oh, this has been, they have done part of this. So let's use that and see if that fits in here. If it does, it's good. If not, we go in and do it by hand.
Wow.
It can be doing one at a time. It can take weeks to months sometimes, depending on how big your protein is.
But you like it?
Oh, yes. This is the best part. This is where like we get answers. This is what we have been like doing all the work for. Even when we are driving here, we are so excited, like, what will I find today? So like now we come back and sit down, drink our coffee and be like, oh, so for example, I can go here and be like, let me see if there's any bonds being formed. So I go turn on the distances and angles. So there's a definite interaction between this and this. Maybe that is what's stabilizing this complex so well. They're forming some kind of bond between two amino acids. So this is what gets us excited, that we have found the interaction that are happening in this complex, what stabilizes this. And if we disrupt this, this can disrupt the motor. This can disrupt the connection it's having or interaction it is having with other proteins.
So once you disrupt this motor, if you could destroy the motor or if you could stabilize it, whatever, just if you had control, then you could start to do things that would affect the chemotaxis.
Yes, bacterial chemotaxis.
You could disrupt the ability for the thing to move where it wants to go.
Yeah, exactly. Like for infection, stopping the bacteria is almost like having an antibiotic, but not with an antibiotic, because bacteria can get resistant to antibiotics. This is one of the many other options that we people.
Maybe you get to invent a new word. Instead of an antibiotic, it's a lethargibiotic. You get to slow them down.
I like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So the flagellar motor exists. And it's amazing. It's complex, and it reminds me of an electric motor, and I love it. Like, I love this thing, and I think it's incredible. There are implications for the fact that something so complex exists and is so integral to the creation of human life. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. So it also opens up a huge debate. People say, well, how can something this complex come to be out of nothing? The logic goes like this. If this motor system is composed of complex individual parts, and all these parts work together to perform the overall function of rotating, then how did the individual parts come to be? Did it all have to happen at the same time? Or is there some evolutionary advantage to the cell for every intermediate stage of development? Is 15% of this motor advantageous to the cell? What function would 50% of the structure perform? What were the steps these components took to assemble into such a complex molecular machine in the first place? Scientists are trying to figure this out, and I encourage you to read their papers. Many seem to be focusing on the type 3 secretion system, which works like a hypodermic needle that a cell can use to inject other things. This device looks similar, but it's quite different in its protein structure. The complexity and origin of the bacterial flagellar motor is a really interesting conundrum. As I was a younger man and I would read things on the internet, I would find people saying, hey, you got to believe all this over here. Or people would say, hey, you got to believe all this over here. There's a big war going on. It's between science and faith, and you're either in one camp or the other. Get your flag and figure out where you're going to put your flag. And the more I have matured and started to not really care about defending where my flag is, the more I've been able to learn from people, no matter where they are. And I'm still working on this. There's a really interesting book that I'm reading. I can't speak for everything in the book. I'm not done with it. It's called Where the Conflict Really Lies. And it talks about this interplay between science, religion, naturalism. It's very interesting. It goes more into the areas of philosophy. And I love it because it challenges me and it's fantastic. So this is what I would encourage you. If you have your flag in a camp somewhere, I would encourage you to not defend a flag. I would encourage you to look at a flagellar motor and just think about it and think about how it is and what it be. It's a fantastic thing to think about. How did this get here? You have intelligence.
and you get to make up your mind. And I love that about consciousness. I love that about life. And so for me, the flagellar motor makes me happy. I feel joy. You know how when you go outside at night and you look up at the stars and you see all these stars and you feel small and you feel wonder? That's what this makes me feel like, even though it is small. I feel awe and reverence toward this thing. And as a Christian, this makes me want to thank God that it exists. I feel compelled with gratitude that this thing is so awesome. So that's just where I'm at. But what I would encourage you to do is just think critically. You have a brain. Don't defend a flag. Just think about how things are. And I hope you are very happy and experience the same joy I feel about this, no matter what you think about it. So anyway, enough about that. I want to say thank you to everybody that supports Smarter Every Day on Patreon. You'll notice there's not a sponsor on this video. I just wanted to make this for you, and I just want to say thank you to everybody that supports at patreon.com/smarter every day. You're smart. You know what I'm doing. I'm just going around asking questions, and that's all these videos are. So this is the 300th episode. So thank you for supporting Smarter Every Day to allow me to do this so long. And I would encourage you, if you're interested, I would ask to consider supporting at patreon.com/smarter every day to let me keep doing it. And if that's not your thing, totally cool with it, because I'm having fun and I'm grateful to all of you. Thank you for watching. I am Destin. You're getting smarter every day. If you'd like to learn more about the deep detail of all this stuff, I'll have a video on the second channel that goes into more discussions about how all this works, but I love it. Big thanks to everybody at Vanderbilt for helping me make this video. I'm Destin. You're getting smarter every day. Have a good one. Bye.
I'm going to make a few comments, and then I'm going to open up for any comments or questions on this video. And I appreciate the patience that you have all demonstrated. It is fairly long. It's very technical. But I have to admire the way it was presented. So the first thing I would point out is, and I'm going to read this slide right here. In the video that we just observed, the host stated that there is an electrical chemical force of some kind that makes this all happen and creates within him a real appreciation and wonder for this whole complex process. This electrochemical force that he is referring to is the etheric body that fuses biologically into these tiny organisms and gives them life and intent, right down onto the lowest levels of the physical plane. You know, we have explored the planetary logo eye, the solar logo eyes, these constellations astrologically and through healing and all different manners of insight. But I find this utterly fantastic. And this gentleman is a good example of a scientist engineer who's trained through the strict discipline of the fifth ray, but you can see he's not attached. You can see his sense of wonder, which is really more along the 246 line, the imagination, the sense of awe that this gentleman is expressing. And more science is moving in that direction. They can't explain why things work. And so this sense of wonder will drive them eventually, maybe with this gentleman, into a deeper understanding of his esoteric Christianity or other people, another tradition. It's just fascinating. And so I'm going to open this up. Are there any comments that anybody would like to make concerning this video?
Yes, we have a couple of comments. We've posted the link for the two videos that you've shown. Thank you, Rose, for the one, and thank you, Greg, for the information, and Ben, for the information on Wikipedia of Destin Sandlin. And then Greg says, and of course, the next steps in life is related and develops into the process of the formation of our own physical vehicles through the autonomic biological processes we know as mitosis and cell multiplication and development, the groundwork for life.
Excellent. This gentleman made a comment, or maybe it was one of the other scientists, that there could be ways of dealing with bacteria other than just like with chemicals. And often bacteria, they adapt, which is another marvelous thing in itself, when if you look at it more impersonally, that there is consciousness in bacteria. Now, Alice Bailey wrote a book called The Consciousness of the Atom, indicating everything down to a simple stone that you can find walking along a path while you're jogging. It has consciousness. Now, granted, it's a very diminished type of consciousness, but nothing is dead or inert, and that the forces of evolution have built this marvelous and magnificent biological machine we call the body. And the more I study it with these new revelations, the more awe you get, not simply from looking at the stars, but maybe a bit of the stars that are influencing these very, very, what we often think of as mundane subjects or happenings or experiences or processes. Okay, good. Any additional comments? Thank you, Greg.
Yes. Heidi says this work was demonstrated in the COVID vaccines that worked on the mRNA.
Excellent. I appreciate that comment. I wrote a 400-page book on COVID and compared what the pharmaceutical industry, the medical profession, were doing for different types of healing technique compared to or versus the esoteric healing techniques found primarily, but not only, in esoteric healing. And it stirred up quite a few people and supported those who know and sensed intuitively that man is an extension of biology that's been around for millions of years, and he has his own immune system. And I'm not saying there aren't cases where maybe vaccines can be helpful or actually work, but we just went through one of the biggest scams in history with this COVID thing. But again, let's not, I have to prevent myself from getting off track, because I agree, Heidi. Thank you for that comment.
Then Francis says he thanks God, and we can also thank the divine consciousness manifesting through the fifth ray into humanity during this cycle.
That's beautifully shared, Francis. And one of the things that the occult student often overlooks in their mad search for liberation and nirvana and getting free from all the trammels of matter is that the fifth ray, even though technically the fifth ray in certain ways the masters tried to hold back because the technical revelations that they were undergoing outstripped their moral development. DK says that the glory of the fifth ray, and where we're in a fifth ray cycle, has yet to be demonstrated. And what he means by that is when the fifth ray can pull itself up from those three lower subplanes that I earlier outlined to the three higher ones, you can feel and you can love, not just through the emotions and not just through the heart, but through the mind, the higher mind, the prototypes, the plans that are the stepping stones to what deity, what the hierarchy want to do at this time historically. And yes, they want us to be liberated from the limitations of matter, but that's an oversimplification. It's more a case of adding to that the ability to redeem what's here, not to pull away from it, not to reject it because of its low vibration, but to see it as a challenge in service to bring it up to higher levels of sensitivity. Because this is what the monad is doing to us via the soul. We're in many ways just like bacteria. And if these higher forces felt pride or contempt for all these lower forms of life, of which we are an intimate part, we would be screwed. So this is all falls under the law of salvation and the law of redemption. Excellent. Any additional comments? Thank you, Francis.
Yes, we do, but we've got two hands up. Go ahead, please, Cassandra. There, you should be able to unmute yourself now, Cassandra. There you go.
Okay. So last month, you spoke about, I forget the name of it, I'm out of town and I had wrote it down. There was like an engine that you were talking about, and it looked almost like this, like an energetical spiraling engine. What was the name of that again?
Well, somebody else who's more observant would have to remember. But I would say this, whenever you get a diversity of heat, light, color, motion, you get friction. And wherever there's friction, there's light. So this is why the study of triangles in the vortex are so important, because triangles have three points, and each point is on a different level. And when energy starts to circulate between these three points, you can see how esoterically energy can be transferred up or energy can be transferred down by this dynamic. And when you see that a triangle eventually is the early stages of the vortex, because when energy is moving around the three points of the triangle faster and faster, it goes from three stationary points to a more blended spherical organism. And this is where you go from the lower mind into the abstract mind.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No,
it was
go
just
ahead.
So fascinating, because last month when I saw that, as a pranic healer for over a decade, I think I became a little bit clairvoyant inside of the chakras, and I could see that spinning, you know, in there. And then when I watched that video, it's like, wow, it's happening above, below, inside, you know, it is everywhere. As above, so below. But anyway.
I love your enthusiasm. It's the same enthusiasm that we all share to a greater or less degree. And you could see in this engineer, in a way, he was like a little child, very intelligent. He was able to assimilate a lot of very esoteric concepts that are dealt with in mainstream science. But he had that flash of enthusiasm that only really comes to me from the second ray. And when more and more scientists bring in the heart, the sense of wonder, the imagination, are you going to see a complete shift historically in scientists not looking just down into matter and taking it apart, but having done that, putting it all back together and saying, what's overshadowing this? What's motivating this? What forces are there that we don't see, like plasma? And I think that may have been my last presentation, was on the subject of plasma, because plasma is 95% of the universe, but you can't see it. But through electrical and magnetic motion and discharges, it creates life. It creates us. So thank you, Cassandra. Any additional comments?
Yes, several of them, but one more hand. But Rose, before I get to you, I just wanted to say that along with his enthusiasm, what he was able to do was take the scientific terminology and put it into layman's terms so that, you know, even those of us who aren't familiar with any of it were able to understand it. And he grilled the other scientists, you mean this, you mean that. And, you know, so I thought that was wonderful the way he was able to do that.
Yes. Step it down without distorting it, the revelation and the technical details. And we are called upon, this is so true, Bea, we're called upon not to get lost in our starry-eyed visions, but to be able to step them down so that the average intelligent person can participate, can join the movement forward out of their limitations. Thank you, BL.
Go ahead, Rose.
Thank you. It's very interesting, that video, in multiple ways. The first thing that comes to mind is how we are, like, the body itself, the physical body, has its own intelligence, has its own life, and we are just borrowing it, because I didn't think up making that little motor for a bacteria or a cell, and I got tons of bacteria in my flora and this and that, but it's like all the processes of the body, it just happens by its own life. So, and as you said earlier, Dwayne, that's like a part of the etheric. So if you go into the etheric, this would be, I guess, the third aspect of matter. And is this where the elementals reside? So is what we're looking at with that intelligence of a bacteria that has a desire to stay alive, to find food, has sensory input, has intention, and works together with other bacteria to do things. That intelligence, is that elemental life? Is that a group life? Is it Deva life? Help me understand the level of consciousness here and what's taking place.
Well, excellent. That's a very, very good question. And I appreciate your comment. Yes, the description of bacteria on the level that was just shared clearly indicates that this is part of the elemental kingdoms. They're involutionary in nature, and without them and the elementals that compose the other parts of our organs and our bloodstream, our nervous system, we would not exist. And so the greater uses the lesser, and in time, those lesser organisms move into consciousness. And this is, you see this in the kingdoms, the elemental kingdom of, let's say, stones, and then the vegetable kingdom. And once you hit the vegetable kingdom, it's mainly elemental life, but it's a higher grade. And then when you hit the animal kingdom, you begin to see an even greater level of response and sensitivity to deity flashing down from these higher levels, because anyone who owns a pet can see that animals respond to love. They respond to devotion. They are developing their astral bodies embryonically and their minds. And these are the characteristics and qualities that have to be built in for them to eventually individualize and go into the human kingdom. And I have watched certain animals that are very intimate to my development. And DK has said that the door to the animal kingdom has closed, but there are exceptions. And if you have pets that you shower with love and devotion and guidance, they may be those exceptions that are transferred earlier into the human kingdom because of your work with them than just say these huge groups of wild animals that they're going to make the grade too, but they're going to be separated and held back for a time. Thank you, Rose. That was excellent. Yeah, elementals.
Okay, we have a number.
Go ahead.
We have a number of comments to some of the things that were said earlier. Let me see. It's always for what is the purpose behind any activity. You know, the divine consciousness is what they were talking about there. And then yes, that is what will draw to it what it truly loves. Francis says to spiritualize matter. And Rose says, a light weaver.
We are all weavers in the light, that's for sure.
Greg says, in essence, we are the products on the physical, astral, and mental vehicles of light weaving. So he agrees with all of you. Ron says, divine consciousness is all in all.
Excellent. That is so true. There was a comment that Cassandra made that I wanted to throw out to the group. She was talking about her stimulation or insight clairvoyantly. And it occurred to me that if any of you have read the theosophical books by Ledbetter, Charles Ledbetter, he was a clairvoyant. And he talked a lot about these sub-biological levels. He saw the permanent atoms. And even though some of it does not parallel with modern science, a lot of it does. And imagine 500 years ago, a yogi who, like Ledbetter, had clairaudient and or clairvoyant vision. Could they not penetrate down onto these very, very minor, minute levels that we require this incredible equipment? I was as impressed with how they get these pictures as the biological motor itself. It was a fantastic video because it explained so much in different departments. But imagine a yogi 500 years ago, before the Industrial Revolution, visualizing and seeing these complex little motors that the divine has made in the physical body. I would think, and maybe this is just wild speculation here, that under certain conditions, the ability to see how chemical reactions create electricity and electricity creates motion, either backward or forward, the differential between different electrical and magnetic charges creates opportunity for movement. And I've often thought, how do some of these inventions historically, how are they made? And maybe we're seeing one of them right here in sort of a simplified embryonic way. Okay, thank you. Any additional comments?
Yes. Joe says, I find the flagellar motor congruent with yesterday's meditation on the time span that I use, which is 9. 9 times 10 is 90. And I am midway in the 10th reiteration. I suspect every individual can use their life number and relate to the flagellar motor. All this is felt in the spleen, in the center of the physical body. It is an autonomic process involving the etheric body. I felt the same when I read M's Gospel of Ramakrishna in 1983.
Excellent. Yes, the spleen is the feeder, to quote the Tibetan, of the Kundalini fire, and it is the storehouse of etheric energy. And it's a minor center considering the other major chakra centers, but it becomes a major center when the disciple is approaching the third initiation. There's a triangle created between the base of the spine, the spleen, the sexual organs, and this is one of the rationales for saving the, I got to be careful how I word this, the seminal fluids that flow through us. In other words, when people reach a certain level of development, it's not required that you're celibate, but there's a natural inclination to take that etheric energy that's generated in the sexual organs and in the spleen, build it up like a dam, and it helps facilitate later on when going through the third initiation to stimulate the base of the spine for that potency and power to be driven up the central channel or the Sushumna. So sorry to go off on a little toot here, but I thought I'd throw that in because the etheric is so important every step of the way. It's not, oh, I'm beyond the etheric. Oh, I'm beyond the astral. No, there are different levels. Thank you, Joe. Excellent. And I love your 9 times 10 is 90. 9, the symbol of total completion. And every one of us is characterized by not just one number, but by a series of numbers. Because as we've demonstrated in other presentations, geometry equals numbers. Color and sound have a geometric expression on certain levels. And that's something we haven't gotten into too extensively, the science of numbers, partially because I'm not that well versed in it, but also it's Alice Bailey and H.P. Blavatsky have held certain aspects of the teachings back because they could be considered premature. Because when you know a person's signature, you know white magic, their signature being color, sound, vibration, number, and all the different things. Okay, excellent. Thank you.
That's all I see for right now.
Okay, excellent. Well, now that we're on the subject of the etheric body, and I really appreciate the comments because some people might find this overly technical or somewhat dry. And in a way, I'm one of those people. But the way this was explained and all the comments that have been made indicates to me a real honest appreciation of not just the subject, but what it alludes to. And what does it allude to? The discovery, the vitalization of the etheric body. And what you see here, and we're going to have a short meditation in a few minutes, what you see here is a duplication of the human etheric body. And the etheric body is grounded and expressed through what are called the nadis, which defined by the Tibetan is tubular vessels. In other words, these look like little streams in this wonderful image, but they are actually tubular. And energy, the tube is like the third aspect of deity. The fluid that flows through it is the second aspect of deity, and it's all impulsed by the first ray, even though we're talking about the seventh ray. All the rays are expressed on all levels, but to different degrees and different potencies. So the tubular vessel is a vortex. It's not like a garden hose. It's rotating. So it's tubular, but it's also vortical at the same time. So let's take a deep breath and really breathe into this next animation, this next video, because it demonstrates what you're experiencing every moment without perhaps being fully aware of it. The etheric body is primarily the color violet. However, every etheric body, just like every astral body, mental body, will also include the color quality of the presiding deity or higher form of life, like your soul, and its unique coloring will affect your personality ray, even though it may be a different one with its coloring. The personality and the soul ray will also affect the astral and the etheric body. So keep in mind that the key colors of the higher etheric human condition understanding the seven levels to the etheric body, the first three are just really gross matter. But when you hit the fourth one, it's the color purple, counting from below up. The fifth one, again, counting from below up, is violet. And then the next one above it, the sixth, is light violet. And then the last one at the first subplane of the etheric is translucent lavender. And that's directly from the Master DK, I think, from Cosmic Fire. So surround yourself with those colors. Wear them. Put up colored gels on your windows with those colors. And when the sun pours through, you'll get a real additional blast of purity and healing in your etheric body, because that's food. That's the mana from them. Okay, great. Any comments on the animation?
We had a couple of comments before, but...
That's all right. No, jump back.
Helen says, these little motors remind me of Spirelli. I don't know how to say that word right.
Spirelli, yes. Yeah. The permanent atoms. No, exactly. That's an excellent observation. The permanent atoms, and I'm going to see if I can scroll down here and then come back up without losing my bearings, which is very easy. Okay. No, I think I removed it. Let's just see. End of slideshow. Okay, I got to get back onto my slideshow here. Shared window is closed. Rose, are you there? I tried something different and I booted myself out. Are you still there, Rose?
Maybe you can see it down at your bottom tray. Can you see the slide? Oh, I don't think you're sharing your screen anymore.
Okay.
You're not. So share your screen again.
Let's do that. Share screen. And be sure it's the correct one, which would be... I have six options. Okay, I think this might be it. Okay.
Yeah, we can see everything there now. So your slideshow is the one that says as above, so below, right?
Yes.
There at the top left. Oh.
Top. I think this may be the wrong, there's two of them. I think it's this one right here.
Yeah, no, I think it was the one at the top, I'm sorry, the top left, because it had the, it was the white background for as above, so below.
Yes. This is the white one. Is this the white one right here that you see flashing?
No, close this one, the little X up at the top, close that.
Okay, yep.
All right, now go back and share your screen because you just unshared your screen.
Okay. Yes. Can you see my desktop?
Not yet.
Okay. Screen one, screen two. Let's see what happens with screen two.
It's getting there. It's not quite there yet. I see a bottom bar, but I don't see anything else.
I see a a bar at the top.
I don't see one at the top.
You are screen sharing.
Yeah.
I don't know how to open it. I don't see an icon that allows me to open it.
Okay. It looks like you're sharing your screen, but I don't. You picked screen two, and I think you probably needed to pick screen one, because
okay.
All we're seeing is the bottom bar. Now I see. Now you're not sharing anymore. So.
Are you there, Rose?
Now I see your desktop.
Okay, now you see my desktop. Okay, why don't I just go over here and reboot it, and let's see what happens right from scratch.
Okay. See the top? See the top left one? I think that was the beginning of this particular webinar today. There you go.
Okay. Do you see anything now?
Yeah, I see the first slide, as above, so below. You're
okay. Well, what I'll do is
Do you have a problem?
I have a major problem.
Okay,
and,
let me fix it for you.
Yeah, would you please?
Hey, sorry, I was away from the phone. Okay. You need to get back to your, what happened?
About 10 things went wrong, so
okay.
We got to start from scratch.
Okay, no, I fix it. Hold on. Okay, I know it's wrong. Oh, this is the wrong one. What happened here?
This is the one that he was using.
I know.
Actually, it's not. PowerPoint 10 rather than PowerPoint.
I understand. I know what happened here. Hold on. I just got to figure out what happened here. I think you clicked on the wrong. Somehow you got out of presenter's mode. So, and did you try to share a different screen?
We were going through all of them because we couldn't find the correct one.
Yeah, it's okay. Hold on here. I just got to figure out. Maybe it's this one.
I think it's because we're in PowerPoint 10 rather than 365.
I just got to figure out which one.
This is PowerPoint 10.
I
need to get into PowerPoint 365.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to close all this, and we're just going to start it back. You remember what slide you're on, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so we got to start. We got to just close all that.
Okay, now.
Okay, yeah, go ahead and reopen it.
Okay, so I take it, and I put it in.
Yeah, that one there.
But that's not the new PowerPoint. That's the old one.
That's the old part. Oh, yeah, you're right. The new one's at the top corner.
Top, which okay. Top corner?
By Skype.
Oh, I
top.
See it. I see it. Okay, excellent. There we go.
I'm sorry. I was trying to multitask being on two webinars at the same time, and I didn't check in on you.
All right. You're here now.
So, all right, we're going to go down here. Okay, you're sharing the wrong screen. Yeah, you're sharing the wrong screen. I don't know how this happened. So we're going to have to change that. Let's give the computer a little bit of time to respond here. It's acting. Let's click the. Can you go ahead and click the presenter's mode button down there? I've done it twice, and I don't know if it's.
Sometimes you have to have it fully open for it to respond.
Okay, there we go. Okay, now all we got to do is get the shared screen back. We got to change that. So you're on the wrong screen here. So, okay, we can go down to. This will stop other screen sharing. How are you selecting the different screens? Did you stop the share or those tools for sharing?
Three different times.
Okay, I'm just going to stop the share and we'll redo it.
Yes, that's the best
approach
is to start from scratch. What's difficult to explain.
Hold on here, Dwayne. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. What? Screen three? Okay, what caused this problem? Something happened because your screen is not there.
He tried to go back to some slides, and he stopped the screen sharing somehow. And we've been trying to get him to, you know, open his presentation up again. And
okay, I got to do something on his computer. Hold on a second. Appreciate everyone's patience.
Well, it demonstrates to me the fragility of technical stuff if you're not well versed in it.
Somehow you've got three screens. That is very... Oh, wait. Okay, hold on. I'm in the wrong Zoom. I'm sorry. All right. Getting confused here. I'm sorry. Okay, hold on. I'm getting confused here because I got two Zooms open. I'm sorry. Here's the other Zoom. All right. I don't know what happened there. I'm sorry.
Please don't apologize for my errors.
Still
the one. I know which one it is. It's under application windows.
Okay, I got it.
There you go.
I got it. Here we go. All right, now, what slide were you on? We got to get out of here.
I can find it. I don't
hold
remember,
on, hold on. Let me do this. Okay, we got to go here. We got to go here. I do this properly.
Okay, I was on slide. Go to slide 12.
Okay. All right, there you are. You should be back good to go.
Okay, now, before we jump into another parallel subject, are there any additional comments either about the videos or the, any one of those videos? Because I know there was a few members here that wanted to share and maybe didn't get a chance.
We have a couple of comments.
Okay,
Selena
excellent.
Says, "This is really interesting, fascinating, and mind-blowing. So grateful for this."
Well, thank you. And I get my mind blown quite often. And it's a great feeling because to have your mind blown means it's expanding. It's exponentially leaping forward, undertaking new vistas of not just technical information, but aspects of the mind of hierarchy, of the mind of the soul, even if it's peripheral, even if it's just tentative.
Joe says, "I see Sanat Kumara watching the colors and hearing the sound. It's like a grand orchestra playing."
Excellent. That is so true. And we are in this symphony, and we play a certain instrument or a series of instruments as the demands are made. And all we're doing is fusing with our group brothers and sisters who are part of the symphony but may play a different instrument and keying them all up so that they're in harmony. That's what the group Antahkarana is. And when you build your own Antahkarana, you contribute to the group Antahkarana. It's because there's a group revelation just as there's an individual revelation. And we can say it's all the same, but the fifth ray demands clarification where the individual revelation is a cell or is the recognition of the soul within the group soul, as Mr. Michael Robbins eloquently would express. Okay, any additional comments?
Yes, Francis says it takes a team in the Aquarian cycle, and you guys just demonstrated that. Thanks.
It also demonstrated my ineptness when it comes to technical stuff. And Francis is very adept at computer work, and his sons are geniuses. Things that Justin has done are just so far ahead of their time. It's just almost laughable. Okay, great. Thank you, Francis. Any additional comments?
Just some thanks all around. So,
okay,
go
great.
Ahead. Go ahead.
So this is an extension right here of a part I left out in our last presentation on the subject of plasma and the Robert Temple's book, A New Heaven, that Rose demonstrated the beauty and the depth of in her presentation at the conference there at the Franciscan Center through the Moyer School in the SRI. So we left this part out, but we're going to go back and just sort of review it a little bit, because it's the intermediate stage between these plasma forces, what Blavatsky and DK call Fohat or cosmic electricity, comes down these streams, begins to crystallize into geometric and sacred geometry forms, and plasma is the last stage before it actually hits the physical, the three lower physical subplanes of the etheric. And so let's review what plasma crystals are. We had geometry, where the prototypes actually come from, that we find down here to a large degree. Plasma is ionized gas with free electrons and ions, typically chaotic and energetic. However, when micron-sized dust particles are introduced into a low-pressure plasma, creating a dusty plasma, these particles become electrically charged by interacting with electrons and ions. They then self-organize due to strong electrostatic column forces, forming highly ordered lattice-like structures that behave like crystals. These are not traditional atomic molecular crystals held by chemical bonds that we are familiar with when you get into the study of precious, not just metals, but precious crystals and their potency. This is the prototypal energy that is so ethereal. It only can be detected as having certain geometric patterns by these specialized vacuum chambers and shooting lasers through them. And Robert Temple's book, A New Heaven, goes into exquisite detail about dusty plasma that we reviewed somewhat in our last presentation. These are the etheric archetypes that lie behind all energy patterns and will be revealed also on the higher astral and mental planes. It gives credence to the statement made by Master DK that God geometrizes. And he also says that it's a natural with second ray types, third ray types, fifth ray types. They can make major contributions, and they can also have some of these more feminine astral Buddhic qualities of visualization that allow for God to geometrize and for us to receive those gifts. But it's a little harder for fifth ray types to do that. So here is a visual. We may have skipped over this, but if you have a cell phone, I apologize, because this is very subtle. If you look into this image, you will see that there are these striations and these geometric forms becoming organized in the background. They look like little dots, and they are, but they're organic, they're self-organizing. Now, Only something that's touched by the divine can be self-organizing, because where does the energy come from? How does this miracle of transmutation and transfiguration from one level to another occur without that ability, without that dynamic? Here's another example. This is a top-down view of a well-formed plasma crystal where hundreds of dust particles arrange in a nearly circular dynamic. So you're really looking at something that's holographic and fractal. And that's why we need videos, we need animation, because black and white and just colored photographs aren't quite enough. Okay, here's another image of plasma, of a plasma crystal. Thousands of micron-sized particles form a crystalline lattice. The dark circular region is a common void that can appear in these systems. Well, I can tell you, I am no expert on plasma crystals, but there has to be polarity on every level, and that dark void may be just the next higher level as plasma manifests itself and connects with matter, connects with the physical plane. And Rose and I hope to be able to explore this in greater detail in up and coming presentations, because it's so important if you're really into the seventh ray. Okay, excellent. Any comments on these visuals or the idea of plasma? Again, a carryover of my last presentation.
Lisa says she thought you were going to say the black and white crystal was space image.
Yeah, doesn't it look like a starry night looking up at these celestial bodies? And as above, so below, the deity, through the law of correspondences, duplicates itself on every level. And that's why, and we certainly can see this from the earlier video, that man is a direct reflection of God. In spite of his imperfections, in spite of his issues and a lot of the lower elemental involutionary substance he works with, he is still an expression of a very, very high level of spirituality. And it's not like you have to recreate yourself into something new and better. You just simply, as Jung said, and I've repeated many times, and I apologize for the repetition, you don't have to create God or even align with God. He, she, it, whatever you conceive of it, is everywhere. It's in your fingertips. It's in the chair you're sitting in. It's in your eyesight. It's in every part of the entire system. And when you understand the esoteric part of just matter itself, you are well on your way to the revelations of what is called, quote, unquote, unprincipled substance. But even that is a somewhat limited term, because everything has consciousness. It's just to a certain degree, and we have to know to communicate with it, with the elementals, with the devas, their language. They don't talk like we talk. They talk through color, sound, number, geometry, heat, vibration, geometric forms. So we have to learn a new language, because it's the deva evolution that comes in with the Christ and is the Christ Force main healing apparatus or operandi, because they don't have gross physical bodies. They're not subject to decay, to deterioration. And their whole purpose is to heal you personally, to heal your group, to heal the planet. And as DK says, there's three levels of devas. There is the lower devas that are involutionary and they're more elemental. They, you must learn to control them. The second level of the devas is those devas that are on the same level as our solar angels. In fact, they make up a part of the solar angels, and that's why the angels are equal to devas and devas angels. But the third statement DK makes is that there are groups of devas that are so advanced that they have been through the human kingdom in earlier cycles, and they have all the qualities of the highest aspect of the human kingdom, and to them we must obey. Obey, cooperate with, and control, and subject to our greater intelligence, the involutionary devas. Okay, good. Any additional comments as we move into a few more videos?
Yes. Heidi says, this image, it looks like our pupils and the iris of our eye.
Excellent. Yes. And why is the organ, biologically speaking, of perception the most advanced in the eye? Because it expresses the soul quality or the personality energies more potently than anything else. Your whole aura spreads out when it meets another person or it interacts, but your eyes are like laser beams. And that's why people can tell a lot about you or others by looking into their eyes. Are they sincere? Are they genuine? Can you trust this person? Or, you know, we don't want to be critical here, but there may be certain people that are not ready for certain types of teachings, and they are better left to their own devices or other discipleship training groups. And I realize I'm injecting here a little of my own, perhaps, insight, which may be faulty, but I think everyone knows what I'm talking about. When you get on a bus, you instantly connect with all the people orally, and you look down at their faces and into their eyes, and it's a thermometer. It tells you safety versus, I don't know. Okay, any additional comments?
Yes. Greg says cosmic mitosis is similar to the microcosmic processes in the womb for the evolution of humanity and consciousness at conception.
Absolutely. Excellent. What is that mantra in biology? Philology? I can't remember. It was. It just indicated that the fetus goes through all the different stages of development of the lower kingdoms before it comes out of the womb and into the human kingdom. There's this recapitulation. There's always a recapitulation. It can be biologically, it can be etherically, it can be astrally. We're recapitulating right now in our daily lives what we've learned and experienced from previous lifetimes. Same thought forms that have to be evolutionary ones lifted up and strengthened, and the involutionary ones bypassed, thrown to the side. They were useful in earlier cycles, but they're no longer useful now. So we literally recreate ourselves, and I know this sounds contradictory because I just said all you got to do is open to everything all around you as far as deity, and it's already there. But those two positions are not mutually exclusive. When you can see you're out of incarnation, at the same time you're in incarnation. Anyway, I got to stop with my... Okay, excellent. Any additional comments?
Yes, several. Heidi says, the singing of our souls becomes the new language.
Yes. that there's a beautiful passage where DK says, "We, science, humanity, they need to learn a new language, a universal language." And yes, we can say it's the opening of the heart. We can say it's the connecting on high mental levels. But there's got to be a spin-off and a descent of that into a new type of language that includes these higher levels. Less verbiage, more direct, intuitive contact. I thought Joe expressed that very eloquently earlier in a few statements that she made. Humanity is going to become telepathic. Therefore, you'll know what's in the mind of your brother and sister. You won't have to be guessing. And yes, there'll be a few stumbles on the way because that's going to be pretty intense, but it will lead to integrity, honesty, purity of motive, and there'll no longer be a place where the involutionary elementals can hide, influencing us negatively. There'll be no mass murders. There'll be no wars because people will recognize the brotherhood of man. Okay, so one more comment and then we're going to move on to closing.
Okay, we only have two more comments.
Okay, good.
Francis says, as humanity evolves, plasma we're experiencing on all levels is increasing in its frequency and vibration also.
Exactly. So true. Plasma is operating on all levels, from the great unbecoming, the unknown, the unborn, the uncreated of pure being, as Mr. Michael Roberts has eloquently shared with all of us. And soon as that fohat comes down, it diversifies and it's all different levels of cosmic electricity that we call plasma down here as the bridge is created between the etheric and the physical. This is seventh ray work. Yes, it includes all the rays, but this is very seventh ray. And it's not to everybody's liking. We're not singing sweet songs, which is admirable. And I love to do mantras and that type of work. Okay, so one more and we're going to...
Okay. Greg says we can look into the eyes of our animal companions to recognize and identify their deeper purposes or counter purposes. And then underneath that, Selena just added a close-up of a whale's eye. It's really pretty. So
yes, or their cry. They have a unique sound and they have a very strong auric field. Okay, excellent. Thank you. And I wanted to do just a little bit on motion. We've talked a lot about the three types of motion: progressive motion, ray one, cyclic spiral motion, ray two, and rotary motion, ray three. And what we're going to do just before closing here is to demonstrate this idea of centrifugal and centripetal motion. DK says, one of the fundamental concepts which is grasped by all magical workers is that both will and desire, two polar opposites here, are force emanations. They differ in quality and vibration, but are essentially currents of energy, one forming an initial vortex or center of activity being centrifugal or moving out, and the other being centripetal and the main factor in the accretion of matter into a form around the central vortex. So I wanted to demonstrate quickly in a few animations that inward and outward dynamic. And note the star formation that it makes, the perfect poise between the two polarities. Excellent. One last animation, it's quite short, that has the same dynamic, and it looks like an eye. Involution, evolution. Radiating out but imploding inwardly. Use it as a meditation. Excellent. Thank you all so much for participating, for your questions and your comments and your tolerance during our little snafus. And BL, I hope I didn't aggravate your leg by going over. But there was so much beautiful group interaction. It really, I think, made it so much deeper.
Yes, that's absolutely what does. And we have just a couple of comments I'm going to read, go through quickly. And then it's a thumbs up. Okay. Heidi says, telepathy is the vibrational level that one attains through its experience on all levels of being. And the communication becomes universal and a deep representation of truth. And then Joe says, imagine all of this group together at the moment, all oming together. And Heidi says, a perfectly balanced electromagnetic mind held in the universal heart. Uh-oh, they're coming in quicker than I can read them. Lightness in being. Thanks so much. Thank you for your revolutionary presentation. Beautiful and fully enjoyed. So yes, very, very good. Excellent feedback today from everybody. So thank you.
Thank you, PL. Thank you very much. Love to everyone. Peace.
And we'll get this posted as soon as we can with the videos included. So you all can go through them again. That one really long one on the, I have to look it up, bacterial flagellar motor. I mean, wow. Okay. Thanks, Dwayne.
Thank you, BL. Blessings.
Bye, everybody.